We're going to begin the prison epistles. What we normally would do is just overview Philippians, Colossians, Ephesians, Philemon. Of course, that's four books. We've been going through, like last time went through 1 and 2 Thessalonians. But to set this up, we've got a series of maps that we're familiar with that we've gone through the second missionary journey where Paul had to go up north and then cross from Troas into Macedonia, had the Philippian church start and Thessalonican church. And that's going to be one of the letters is going to go to the Philippians. And then his third missionary trip, he came straight through the mainland and went through Colossae, went to Ephesus and was there for 3 years. And that's where he writes the letters to the Corinthians from Ephesus. We'll look at that's the third missionary journey. And then after that, he, after leaving Corinth, he goes to Jerusalem. And that's kind of where we pick up, you know, in 57 AD, he's going to arrive in Jerusalem, and several things happen. And I know we've gone through Acts already, but because of my mind, the way my mind works, I could not get to here where he's in prison writing these epistles. I think because we're following those maps. I want to follow that map and see him get to Rome and be in Rome in 60 to 62 AD and have the setting of when he, where he is and where he's, what's been going on in his life when he writes from prison to the Philippians, to the Colossians, to the Ephesians, and to an individual named Philemon. Now, Philemon is an individual who lives in the city of Colossae. So, you know, there's two letters, and there's people that are carrying these letters, there's people going back and forth. We will assume he wrote more than these letters from prison, but these are the ones that we have. Again, we got to assume that Paul wrote maybe hundreds of letters, that and we've got the collection that we've got. So with that being said, open your Bibles, and you can see I've got maps on there, and I'm not going to flash them up on the screen yet, but on your notes you can see the second missionary journey, the third missionary journey, and I've also got the fourth missionary, or third, yeah, the prison trip. But beginning in, well, let's say Acts 21, and I'm, like I say, we're in Acts 21, and we've got to get to Acts 28 tonight, and there's just so many, I guess, fun details in these verses. It's such a clear story of what's taking place. But in chapter 21 of Acts, verse 17, he has left Corinth. Remember, he was going to leave Corinth. And if you read the verses right above that, he was going to go by ship from Corinth, but there was an assassination plot, so he had to go up through Macedonia and come through a different way. And in chapter 21, verse 17, when we arrived at Jerusalem, the brothers, now this is at the end of the third missionary journey, and he's gone to Jerusalem, and he's bringing that money that, and Steve shared something the other night. We talked about how they're carrying all this, it wasn't paper money, it had to be coins, and how they're carrying all this money. It seems like a lot of money from the Macedonians and the Corinthians that they're taking back to Jerusalem. And Steve had done some research and found out that there was a banking system, which, I mean, it isn't surprising, but I guess if you never thought of it, that you could get, what'd you call them, the certificates? So you'd get, you'd deposit it in one Roman bank, and they'd give you a note for it. You could take that note and go to another Roman bank, and they would verify it, and you wouldn't have to carry coins across the sea and, you know, have people carrying chests of coins and have your own guards, you know, taken care of. You could just take a promissory note. Of course, right away, they should think, well, what about fraud? Well, I'm sure they had their fraud and they had a way of dealing with it, but I'm sure they dealt with it quite a bit different. The Romans, soldiers, military, Praetorian Guard probably dealt differently with fraud than we do. And nonetheless, that's another story. Maybe we will someday man up and deal with fraud. Nonetheless, notice he arrives there and he's got that money. It doesn't say that in the verse, but we know that from the story. Verse 21, verse 18. The next day, Paul and the rest of us went to see James. So who's writing this book? Luke. So Luke is with Paul and the rest of us, I assume Timothy, Silas, went to see James. Now, James is Jesus' brother. He's the head of the Jerusalem church. He's already written the letter called James. He's already had the Jerusalem council, and all the elders were present. Now, you'd like to know who those elders are. Who are those people? Paul greeted them and reported in detail what God had done among the Gentiles through his ministry. And once again, he's in the heart of Jerusalem, the heart of Judaism. These people have become believers, but he's taken the gospel and they support it. But again, cultures are overlapping here. And It's, you know, Paul's definitely a missionary in this sense. When they heard this, they praised God. Then they said to Paul, "You see, brother," now, oh boy, this is so interesting. I've got all this highlighted in yellow. I've got different colors. Blue in my Bible means God's will, God's word. Green means some kind of blessing. Yellow means evil. It means this is shaky ground. And so all this is in yellow right here because, well, let me just read it very quickly to you. When they heard this, they praised God. Then they said to Paul, "You see, brother, how many thousands of Jews have believed, and all of them are zealous for the law." We're right back to the law. Look, all the Jews have come to Christ, but they're very zealous for the law. You've been hanging around, they say, you've been hanging around with the Gentiles. And so these guys that are following the law real close, they don't know, maybe, and again, you can understand this. They're, maybe you've been tarnished. Well, let's hear what they say. Now, this is the elders in James's group yet. They're still trying to process all this. "They have been informed that you teach all the Jews who live among the Gentiles to turn away from Moses, telling them not to circumcise their children or live according to our customs." Now, that's not what Paul's doing, but that's what's come back on the rumor mill, or that's what all the memes are looking like. "What shall we do? They will certainly hear that you have come, so do what we tell you. There are four men with us who have taken a vow. Take these men to the Temple Mount." And we're going to spend some time on the Temple Mount. They're going to go up to the Temple Mount here. So they're somewhere here in the Jerusalem city, but they're going to come up here. These four men have taken a vow, and they're going to go up to the Temple Mount. "Take these men, join in their purification rites according to the law of Moses, and pay their expenses so that they can have their heads shaved." I mean, they'd go up there, they'd go through their rituals, they'd pay the money, they'd have their heads shaved, and now they've taken a vow. "Then everyone will know there is no truth in these reports about you, but that you yourselves are living in obedience to the law." Just go up on the Temple Mount, go through some rituals, show them you're still a good Jew. "As for the Gentile believers, we have written to them our decision that they should abstain from food sacrificed to idols, from blood and from the meat of strangled animals, and from sexual immorality." Now, we know what letter that was. We've already read that. That's the letter they wrote, James wrote at the end of the Jerusalem Council, that Paul's carried with him and shared with the Gentiles. So we've already dealt with the Gentiles, say, don't do this, but you being a Jew, you have to do a little bit more. "The next day," now again, is this a mistake or not? That's why I've got this in yellow. Is this good? Would you say, "Oh yeah, I'll do that"? Or do you think this is a? I'm not going to give you an answer. I just think this is questionable. And again, you can think about that. "The next day, Paul took the men and purified himself along with them." And I'm not going to say there's anything wrong with it. I don't know if it's sin. It's just, I don't know, kind of weaselly. And this is day two. "Then he went to the temple to give notice of the date when the days of purification would end and the offering would be made for each of them." Now, the very fact the book of Hebrews is going to be written and say we have nothing with this temple, we've got a greater temple, we've got a greater priest, greater high priest, it means, like, Paul, are you ready for the book of Hebrews yet? Or do you really think you're going to go? He's actually functioning in the temple, in the temple courts. It's a 7-day vow, 7-day, and that's the next thing. Verse 27, "When the 7 days were nearly over," this would be day 8 or 9 that they've arrived. He's been in Jerusalem 8 or 9 days, about a week. "Some Jews from the province of Asia," now you know where Asia's at, that's Ephesus, that's that area there, Colossae, "saw Paul at the temple. They stirred up the whole crowd and seized him." So there's Jews that have caused problems for him in Galatia. They caused problems for him in Thessalonica. They caused problems for him in Berea. They caused problems for him in Corinth. And now they see him on the Temple Mount. They go, "That's that guy." And these are not Christian Jews. These are non-believing Jews in the sense that they've rejected Christ. But now they see Paul there, and the whole crowd, they stir him up shouting, "Men of Israel, help us! This is the man who teaches all men everywhere against our people and our law and this place," meaning the Temple Mount. "And besides, he has brought Greeks into the temple area and defiled the holy place." Now you understand, There's a temple. He hasn't taken anybody into the temple. He hasn't taken them into, you know, where the altar's at, but he's taken them into the court, they say, the court where the Jewish men would go. And there's a place for the Gentiles to worship. There's also a place for the Jewish women to worship. But the Gentiles have to stay in the Gentile court. They say he's brought them in with the Jews. He's mingled Gentiles with you Jews. And besides, he has brought Greeks into the temple area and defiled this holy place. They had previously seen Trophimus. That's mentioned. He's mentioned 2 Timothy again. The Ephesians. So Paul's been in Ephesus for 3 years, and there's some Ephesians traveling with him, and here's one of them in the city with Paul. So he's there, but he would not take him into the temple courts with Paul. They see him with Paul in the city of Jerusalem and assumed that Paul had brought him into the temple area. Lucas said he didn't. They just assumed it. The whole city was aroused. So the whole city of Jerusalem now aroused after Paul. And the people came running from all directions, seizing Paul. They dragged him from the temple. That's the area in front of the temple where he would have been, and where he went to take the vow and pay the fee. And immediately the gates were shut. They shut the temple down because it's been defiled. I mean, it's like the days of Antiochus Epiphanes or something. While they were trying to kill him, meaning right there, the Jews are killing him right there in the temple courts. News reached the commander of the Roman troops that the whole city of Jerusalem was in an uproar. Now, the commander of the Roman troops is going to be at Fort Antonia, and we're going to spend some time looking at that. Fort Antonia is right here. This is the wall, the east wall of the temple. This is the south of the wall. This is the north, and this is where Fort Antonia is outside. But that's where it's just a little bit higher, and they can look down on the temple courts, and that's where the Roman troops would stay. And then, so Fort Antonia heard this. The Roman commander, took some officers and soldiers and ran down to the crowd. When the rioters saw the commander and the soldiers, they stopped beating Paul, because now the Romans are on the scene. The commander came up and arrested him, Paul, and ordered him to be bound with two chains. Now we're going to find out that they think Paul's somebody else. They think he's a terrorist from Egypt. Then he asked who he was and what he had done. Some in the crowd shouted one thing. It's basically a riot. He's trying to get information. One people shouted this, some another thing. And since the commander could not get at the truth because of the uproar, he ordered that Paul be taken into the barracks. And the barracks would be Fort Antonia. When Paul reached the steps, the violence of the mob was so great, he had to be carried by the soldiers up the steps into Fort Antonia. The crowd that followed kept shouting, "Away with him!" Verse 37, as the soldiers were about to take Paul into the barracks, he asked the commander, "May I say something to you?" "Do you speak Greek?" he replied. So the Roman, he speaks Greek, but he in his mind thinks Paul is a terrorist from Egypt that they've been trying to hunt down. He's on the most wanted list. He's an illegal immigrant. He's you know, ICE is looking for him. And they think, we've got this guy. Which again is going to be interesting, because the color of his skin, the his facial recognition, his dress, is they don't say, "Well, you look like a white guy from Tarshish up north." They think he's an Egyptian from down south in the Jerusalem temple, rounding up assassins to lead a revolt against Rome. That's who they think they've got. And when Paul says, "Can I say something?" And he's like, "Wow, you don't even have an accent. It's like you speaking Greek. That's pretty good Greek. Where'd you learn that?" "Do you speak Greek?" he replied. "Aren't you the Egyptian who started a revolt and led 4,000 terrorists out into the desert some time ago?" Paul answered, "I am a Jew from Tarshish in Cilicia, a citizen of no ordinary city. Please let me speak to the people." Once again, Paul thinks, "I'll just negotiate my way out of this," or not negotiate, but he'll teach his way out of this. Having received the commander's permission, Paul stood at the steps going up to Fort Antonia, and motioned to the crowd. When they were all silent, he said to them in Aramaic. Now he's speaking their language. "Brothers and fathers, listen now to my defense." When they heard him speak to them in Aramaic, they all became quiet. So now they're all quiet. Then Paul said, "I'm a Jew, born a citizen." He goes through and talks about being trained by Gamaliel, and we've read all this. But he talks about being a, and he starts explaining Christ. But when he talked about Christ, and you can see all the he's giving them that lecture. Go to verse 22 of chapter 22. Verse 22 of chapter 22. The crowd listened to Paul until he said this. And what he said was when the Lord appeared to him, because they're like, oh, a vision. They believe in visions. They believe in angels. They believe in encounters with, you know, God. And it's like, they're like, oh, this is interesting. You know, a new revelation. They've been waiting for the prophet. You know, they've been waiting for the prophet to introduce the Messiah. And they've rejected that. But maybe this time it's going to be the real deal. But Paul says, then the Lord said to me, in verse 21, go, I will send you far away to the Gentiles. The crowd listened to Paul until he said this, and now the Jewish crowd is like, the Lord is not going to come and tell you, a Jew, to go to the Gentiles. He's been telling us for 2,000 years, stay away from the Gentiles. That's how they understood it. Then they raised their voices and shouted, rid the earth of him. He's not fit to live. As they are shouting and throwing their cloaks and flinging dust into the air, the commander ordered Paul be taken into the barracks. He directed that he be flogged and questioned in order that he find out why the people were shouting at him like this. And they stretched him out to be flogged. Then Paul said to the centurion, and again, we've talked about that, stretch him out to flog him, no trial, and they're just going to beat him to get the truth out of him. And he says to the centurion standing there, is it legal for you to flog a Roman citizen who hasn't even been found guilty? When the centurion heard this, he went to the commander and reported. So you got the commander being the centurion, over 100 men, going to the commander who's in charge of the whole Fort Antonia. And the centurion says, did you know we've got a Roman citizen bound here and we're about to beat him? And the commander went to Paul and asked, tell me, are you a Roman citizen? Yes, I am, he answered. Then the commander says, I had to pay a big price for my citizenship. Very interesting. The commander of the Fort Antonia, of all the Roman troops, purchased his Roman citizenship, but yet he's over Roman soldiers that were, many of them probably were born citizens. But Paul says, I was born a citizen. Those who were about to question him withdrew immediately. Everybody went on lunch break and just vanished. They didn't want their photo in the, their face in the photo. The commander himself was alarmed when he realized that he had put Paul, a Roman citizen, in chains. Now, this is the same thing that happened up in Philippi, and when they found out they put a citizen in chains. The same thing here. The next day, now this would be day 9, since the commander wanted to find out exactly why Paul was being accused by the Jews, he released him and ordered the chief priests and all the Sanhedrin to assemble. So the Sanhedrin is asked to be assembled. The commander of the Romans asked the centurion or the Sanhedrin to assemble so they can listen to Paul and have a trial for Paul. Then he brought Paul and had him stand before them. Paul looks straight at the Sanhedrin, and we'll pick that up in verse chapter 23 in a moment. But what I want to do is show you a few things, and I'm not sure if this is important or worth doing. This is some things that you may find interesting. Again, I do. See that picture right there? It's the same picture, except, I mean, I took a lot of them. That's a broad picture looking right here. What I'm doing there, standing on the Mount of Olives, looking right here at this right here. See, there's up north. This is the east wall, and this is Fort Antonia. Here's the east wall going south, and here's some steps coming up into the temple right here. We'll take a look at that. And I just hope to find this interesting. I like this kind of thing, so if we can see, I'm going to show you where Paul was at generally in Fort Antonia, and then he's going to go be shipped over to Caesarea before he goes to Rome. And I'm going to be able to show you probably, well, very likely, the floors he walked on and possibly where he stood before Felix and then Festus and Agrippa. But nonetheless, here you can see this. This is the east wall. That's the Dome of the Rock. And the eastern gate would be, you know, right in this general area here. And we'll look at that here in just a moment. This now, I've just moved down this way. This is now the southwest corner. This is the Temple Mount. Like when you're walking on the Temple Mount, this would be where they would walk. The temple, there's a right there is the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. That's where Christ was crucified, right? Right there. That's Calvary right there. Underneath that small dome, that's Calvary. I mean, there's no doubt about it. I mean, you certainly should look into it. You should question, say where, you know, it's 100%, almost 100%. But that is where Calvary's at. And then this is where the garden was, where he was resurrected. And so that's how close. While they're sacrificing the lamb here at 3 o'clock for the evening sacrifice, Jesus was dying there at 3 o'clock at the same time. But anyway, we're going here again this way. Can you see this okay? Am I in your way? There's the Church of the Holy Sepulchre right there again. I caught the shadow of the cross on this little dome is on that right there. You can see we're moving south this way. These are original steps. There's a double gate right here, a triple gate here. And these steps, when Jesus would teach, he would have sat on these steps. Everyone said this, not everyone, but teachers, rabbis. And all around this area, when you go down in here, you walk through it, you can see mikvahs, which are like places of where they'd have water. Steps going down that you could dip in the water and come out so you could cleanse yourself before you went up into the temple courts. And when the Holy Spirit came on the day of Pentecost, this is where they began preaching. They might have been preaching down in this area, but they're on the temple courts preaching, and this would have been where everyone is getting baptized on the day of Pentecost. I mean, it's almost 100%. It was just right there. They didn't go to the Jordan River. They were getting baptized into the name of Christ in the Jewish mikvahs, were water to be cleansed to go to the Temple Mount. Okay, we're going to zoom in on these steps. This is a model. See the people? That's the double gate. I'm going to stand in front of that double gate. See the steps? There's the triple gate right there. This would be the colonnade going all, Solomon's colonnade going all the way around the temple. There's the temple over here. This is the south of the city. This would be where Pentecost would have happened. There it is today. Then there's those steps, the corner, the Temple Mount. That's the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Solomon's colonnade used to run all the way around. There's a Dome of the Rock, not Dome of the Rock, but that's Al-Aqsa Mosque right there. The steps coming up to the double gate. And here's another picture of them, because you see right here, some of these are rebuilt. They've got new pavement sitting on them, or not, yeah, but new, you know, slats, new stone. But these are originals. These are cut out. This is when Abraham would have walked up Mount Moriah. This is the mound he was walking up. There would have been, you know, dirt and grass growing, you know, whatever's happening here. And there was a threshing floor up here that they would go up to in David's day when he purchased this. But as they developed, they cut into the bedrock. And these are steps. So these steps, Jesus definitely walked on those. I mean, James, Peter, they walked on these steps. These steps are all new stones they've laid on those steps because they've been worn down. And that's Mount Moriah, cut right into Mount Moriah. All right, there it is. There's those steps again. I just was impressed when I got there and saw. My gosh, that's the steps going up to, and anyone that pilgrims would go up to the temple, they'd walk up these steps. There I am standing there. This is the south wall of the temple. This was a crusader wall built for their defense. They built right over the top. That's one of the things about history. They start building on, they're trying to save the cities. They build on top of other stuff. But I'm leaning against this crusader wall. There's the double gate right here, and there's those steps that come up there. Now I'm standing on those steps taking a picture down the steps. This is the Kidron Valley, and that's the Mount of Olives. There's three high points of the Mount of Olives, and that's one of them, but there's the Kidron Valley, and the temples to my background there. There it is again, looking up at the double gate right here, Crusader building here, Al-Aqsa Mosque, see the Muslim symbol right there. Now, we go up on these steps. We go up here and walk along these walls. A lot of these stones are built, added, you know, you see how small they are, and so they get bigger. There's different types of stones. Because a lot of times they'd fall over, they'd rebuild it. But when you get right up here along the top row of the steps, you can see these right here. This is the master court. See how big these are Herodian stones. And you see they're big stones. I can show you. Look how big they are. See? There's Tony right there. See, that's how tall those stones are. And they've still got the original. These stones, this was knocked over by the Romans. They knocked them over. They got down here, they're too big. But these were pushed over, and then they were rebuilt by, you know, whoever was coming in to build them. But that's original right here. These stones are original first century temple. And now that's right here. Now we're looking back at the center. The eastern gate is right here. That eastern gate is probably, well, I know, there's that's a This was built sometime in the 1500s, where that was built, but then the Ottoman Empire built up to go around the city. And so they built this, but underneath there is the first century gate. I can show you a little bit of that later. But there's always, when they build, they have to build on the rubble. Just like Nehemiah, he had to build on the rubble, and they'd use the stones again. There's the Dome of the Rock, where the temple would have stood here. Fort Antonio, where Paul was taken, is right up here. Now, it's a school now. It's a Muslim school right now built on that. Here is, we're looking from this, a model, looking from the Mount of Olives at the Temple Mount. This is the temple. This would be where the altar was for the burnt offering. And then you're going to have the court of Jewish men here. The Jewish men here. There'll be a court of women here. Then there'll be a place for the Gentiles to meet. And Paul was in this area here. This is where the riot broke out when someone says, ah, he's brought a Gentile into here, and the Gentile should have been out here. This is Solomon's colony. See the pillars? That goes all the way around the temple. And then there would be wooden beams. This is important. I'm saying wooden beams, cedars of Lebanon on the top of those pillars. There's cedar of Lebanon in the temple. And then that would, you could walk all the way around. This, don't forget, Solomon of Colonnade, the pillars, and on top of those pillars would be beams, cedars of Lebanon, that would be built on top of that. The steps I've shown you are on this side. This is, again, is a model. That's the Golden Gate right there. So here's the temple, Temple Mount. The temple would be right here. That would be the top of Mount Moriah. That's where the temple would have stood. That's where the Dome of the Rock's at today. That's the Eastern Gate we're looking at right now. There's the Eastern Gate. Now we're down into the Garden of Gethsemane, looking over the Kidron Valley and walking up to the Golden Gate. Again, the original Golden Gate is still buried, but you can still see it on the other side. But this would really be nice to excavate. You can't, because they've got people buried all over, so you'd be defying the Jews. If you go somewhere else, you're defiling the Muslims. But yeah, this would be fun to excavate. But nonetheless, that's the Golden Gate today. They used to open this up for Easter when the Byzantine Empire, before the Muslims took over, and then they'd have a procession in there. But after, once they'd walled it up, the Muslims walled it up, and they won't let them take it down now, because the Messiah is supposed to walk in there. And so they've stopped that. It can't happen now. See, it's walled shut. So when Jesus comes back, he's going to get here and be like, oh, I was so disappointed. He can't get in. At least it's worked so far. It's worked so far. Okay, there again, same thing, the Golden Gate or the Eastern Gate. The temple's on this side. We're zoomed in from the Mount of Olives. See all these tombs? Now, that's the outside of the wall. Now we're inside, right here. Tony is standing right here, on the inside, right here. Now, I'm going to show you something cool, I think. Okay, I got several things straight that I think are cool. You're making your decision right now, thinking, I am wasting a Monday night. At least you got Tony's birthday cupcakes. Okay, so this, now, see, this is the Golden Gate, but as you look down here, there's stuff below here. And this is the surface of the Temple Mount today, but it'd be nice that a lot of that's been paved, so it's functional. It'd be nice to dig down and find out what's underneath there. Okay, here it is again. Now, this is me taking a photo from the inside at the Eastern Gate down into here. I want you to notice these. See that right there? There it is again. I'm taking another photo. Arabic right there. Arabic. See this right here? The wooden beams, those old 6x6s or 12x12s, those old beams. One time I was there in 2007, and in the far corner, I don't know if I got a picture of it here yet, or in here, but there was smoke going up on the Temple Mount, just burning. They're burning these. It's like what Muslims were burning on the Temple Mount. And I was still putting things together. Why were they burning stuff? The same reason when they excavate, when they did some excavation, they crushed all the dirt and threw it away, so you couldn't find any Jewish evidence. There I'm standing on those again, taking pictures. And right here, Eastern Wall, Eastern Gate, or the Golden Gate. And these beams, see the notches? Ancient cedar timber. They have been dated to 950 BC. They're cedar, and they originated in Lebanon. These are from Solomon's temple. And so how can it last long? Well, it's cedar. It doesn't decay. Plus, it was covered up probably inside for centuries and then buried. If you do the search, yes, cedar beams from the time of Solomon's temple have been found on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. These beams, dating back to the first temple period, were discovered during the renovation of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. There's a whole study because the Al-Aqsa Mosque, if you remember, it's standing right here. And this wall, the Temple Mount, see like the rock? You remember the rock? Solid bedrock goes up like this. There's a mound there, solid rock. But over here, what is this? That's bats filled. This is a retaining wall, and that's dirt filled in. It's because you go up the steps right here, and you're walking on solid bedrock, and you continue up. You can still see the stairsway when you look at it from this way, coming up here. They built out and around this. In fact, Herod built out and around this. Then they filled it in with dirt. So whenever there's an earthquake, this baby doesn't move. The Dome of the Rock is sitting on Mount Moriah bedrock. This right here is like a sandbox. So in the bedrock shake, this, and the Al-Aqsa Mosque always breaks down at some level. And so when they're in there renovating, they found the beams in the Al-Aqsa Mosque that's been recently built historically, but they've got beams in there that are from 950 BC, still preserved in the mosque. And that's what they found when they found it in the Al-Aqsa Mosque being renovated. See this picture they've got out of there? There's Tony walking. Again, there's the Golden Gate. She's walking this way. There's some more of those beams. If you Google cedar beams on Temple Mount from Solomon's Temple, you get these pictures like this. See right there? That's that piled up in the corner. That's what I saw burning one there. There's this right there, Cedars of Lebanon. There's some piled up. They got some like stored away somewhere. And then you get a couple pictures here. Oh, cool. The Generation Word pictures pop up right up in there. There's Tony right there. Same picture. That's a Google search right there. And anyway, so those are the beams right there that you're looking at. There's also some down here. You can't see them. I took a video of this without taking a picture of it, but there's a whole pile of beams down in this corner right there you can see on the video. But that's inside. See that right here? That's down. The Eastern Gate is down lower, and there's stuff below that even. Okay, so that's the Eastern Gate. That's the inside the Eastern Gate. There's a cedar. There's that far corner. The Al-Aqsa Mosque is, this we're looking at the back corner. This corner right here would be right back here, the southeast corner. And there's just all kinds of junk timber right there. And you see these things right here? They're from something. Here's the four down to nine. Here's the Eastern Gate. Here's those steps I was talking about, and this is where you go up the stairs and come out on the Temple Mount. This is four down to nine is right here. So Paul, the riot broke out here. The guards, military came down, took him up to four down to nine right here. Here is the temple looking at it from the east, from the Golden Gate, a model. Here's Solomon's colony going all the way around. And right here, 1, 2, 3, 4, you can't see them there. Those are the four corners of Fort Antonia. Solomon's colony goes, watch, see, colony goes right there. So there's beams on those pillars. And there's the Dome of the Rock. There's the Dome of the Rock. There's the Dome of the Rock close up. There's Tony hiding behind the pillar. There's some properly dressed women. There's the Dome of the Rock. There's the Eastern Gate. And right over here, this wall right here is, this would be where Fort Antonia was. Paul's taking it right up there. And there's bedrock right here. See right there? That's the bedrock on that wall right there. Right along, that's where the Solomon's colony would have ran, right along there. And this is, see the bedrock right here? There's bricks built up, different types of bricks right in here. And they planted huge pine trees right across here. And I noticed that the first time. See these notches right here? Those are carved by the Muslims into the bedrock because they had some kind of structure there sometime during the last 1,400 years. But there, see those trapezoids? Is that what you call that? It's like a trapezoids. They're all evenly spaced across here. But Solomon's colony used to run across here. There'd be pillars, and then the wooden beams would go up into, see these right here, these stones? you can see if it zoomed in and looked at them, those are Herodian stones. You can see they're cut. They're not the same as these CZ stones. These are not Herodian. These are the trapezoids of the Muslims. That's the school right here, Muslim school. There's the trapezoid holes. The Muslims use that for something, but right up here in the Herodian stones, if those trees, that's what, look at those trees. Isn't that interesting? Those trees are planted right there. There's the trapezoids. See, in the bedrock, see, that's part of Mount Moriah, keeps rising right up there. There's the trapezoid close. But right up in here, Herodian stones behind the, and I've got a picture here. Here's our Fort Antoniah. This is another model, Fort Antoniah. Here's Solomon's colonnade. On these pillars would have been beams, and I'm trying to point out that those beams would have had to have notches cut into the bedrock of this part right here. Just like the Muslims cut those trapezoids, Solomon's colonnade would have had notches right there. That's the north. See, the temple's down here. The Dome of the Rock is down here. This is where Paul was taken up here. This is where he was strapped down. The commander came out, and the centurion says, we've strapped down a Roman citizen. They would look just, I mean, this is a model of what it would have looked like. And there, I got one. I got one right there in a picture. See that square? That's a square notch in a Herodian stone, the same size as those beams that we saw. And this would have been where the pillars were standing. And Solomon's colonnade would have gone right across, right there's those 19-inch square sockets in Herodian ashlar. So that's been there since Paul went through that area. Right there is remains of one of the columns from Herod's temple or Solomon's colonnade. There's several pictures of it here. There's the crown right there, the capital right there. There it is again from another angle. So that's where the beam would have set on all the way around. There would have been hundreds of those all the way around the temple. There's the base. You see that's molding there. And what's interesting is this is Delta. It's got so they think it's possible that it was a numbered on how where they placed them or something like that. There's some more. These are definitely remains from the temple of that time period. In chapter 23, he's speaking to the Sanhedrin in chapter 23, and they're listening to him because he is a Pharisee, and so there's Sadducees and there's Pharisees. The Pharisees are conservatives, and the Sadducees are liberals. Imagine the Democrats and the Republicans, and now you've got a Republican speaking, and the Republican, or Paul, or the conservative, believes in this case, that there's going to be a resurrection from the dead. Or let's just say he believes that there's only two genders. But he's talking to the Sanhedrin, the Congress, or the Senate, and some of them believe there's only two genders, but some of them are Sanhedrin, or excuse me, some of them are Sadducees, and again, to compare them to the Democrats or the liberals, they think there's many genders. And so they're all listening to Paul speak because he's a Jew, and he's speaking. And then it comes down right here, chapter 23, verse 6. Then Paul, now he's ordered by the Roman commander of Fort Antoniah, the whole Sanhedrin, this is the governing body of Israel, has assembled to hear Paul and find out what he's doing. So he's going to preach the gospel just like he did on Mars Hill, just like he did in all the synagogues. He's now got the entire Sanhedrin assembled, and he's going to explain to them the gospel. But he's also on trial. Some want to kill him. Look in verse 6. Then Paul, knowing that some of them were Sadducees and the others Pharisees, called out in the Sanhedrin. Now, that's important because if you're just reading your Bible like at night before you go to sleep, and I did for years, and the Sadducees and Pharisees, it's like, okay, some were Democrats and some were Republicans, and he called out to the Sanhedrin, my brothers, there are only two genders. Well, what's that going to do to the Republicans? The Republicans are going to go, yes, this guy should be innocent. The Democrats go, he needs to be in prison for transgender sins or something, whatever. Well, Paul, knowing that some of them were Sadducees and others were Pharisees, called out in the Sanhedrin, my brothers, I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee. I stand on trial because of my hope in the resurrection of the dead. When he said this, a dispute broke out between the Pharisees and the Sadducees. No longer is Paul on trial. He just flipped the whole trial back on them. And now they're arguing across the aisle back and forth on if there's a resurrection in the future or if there's not a resurrection in the future. The Sadducees say that only that there is no resurrection and that there are neither angels nor spirits, but the Pharisees acknowledge them all. Luke adds that. There was a great uproar. Some of the teachers of the law who were Pharisees stood up and argued vigorously, "We find nothing wrong with this man." So half the Sanhedrin says, "He's innocent. He should be able to go free." And the others, of course, are saying, you know, that he's guilty. Verse 11, this is one of the important themes of this whole night. The following night, the Lord stood near Paul and said, this is the first that of the several times this is going to happen by the end of the book of Acts, and says, "Take courage. As you have testified about me in Jerusalem, so you must testify about me in Rome." And so when you go back and read all that took place right here, God is saying, we're going to do the same thing in Rome. You're going to be put on trial for an issue, and I'm going to give you the chance to share the gospel in Rome. And now, he's never been to Rome. Christianity's already there. But notice right here, what took place right there, however it happened, God was either using it or pleased. It was his plan. It's like there, we just testified to the entire Sanhedrin, the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the Pharisees all heard the gospel. The next day, day 10, Paul's been in Jerusalem 10 days now. The next morning, the Jews formed a conspiracy and bound themselves with an oath not to eat or drink until they had killed Paul. More than 40 men were involved in this plot. They went to the chief priests and elders and says, "We have taken a solemn oath not to eat anything until we kill Paul." So they're telling the chief priest this. "Now then, you and the Sanhedrin petitioned the commander to bring him before you on a pretext of wanting more accurate information about the case. We are ready to kill him before he gets here. But when the son of Paul's sister," would be Paul's nephew, "heard about this plot," now, I mean, do you think the son of Paul's sister must be like a little boy playing ball out in the street and heard it? Or he's probably not a teenager. He's probably 20, 25, 30, 35 years old. He hears about this plot. He heard about the plot. He went into the barracks and told Paul, "They're going to ask for you to be brought out for more information. They're going to kill you on the way to the Sanhedrin this time." Then Paul called one of the centurions and says, "Take this young man to the commander." So the centurion, another centurion, is going to the commander, Fort Antonia. "He has something to tell him," so he took him to the commander. The centurion says, "Paul, the prisoner, sent for me to ask you me to bring this young man." The commander took the young man, all this, and it takes place. The commander, in verse 22, dismisses the young man and cautions him, "Don't tell anyone what you have that you reported this to me." Then he, the commander, called two of his centurions and ordered them, "Get ready a detachment of 200 soldiers, 70 horsemen, and two..." Let me read this again. The commander gets two centurions and tells them to get 200 soldiers, 70 horsemen, and 200 spearmen to go to Caesarea at 9 tonight. They're not going to make have a press conference. They're not going to put it on Twitter. "We're just going to go at 9 o'clock. Get ready. You guys are marching to Caesarea. Provide mounts for Paul so that he may be taken safely to Governor Felix." So now they're going to be going to Caesarea. So this large detachment, 200 spearmen, 70 horsemen, and what 200 soldiers are all escorting Paul because they're trying to keep the Jews from killing Paul. He's going to go down to Caesarea, which is right on the coast. And he wrote the letter as follows: "Claudius Lysias to His Excellency Governor Felix." So now we know the name of the commander. "This man was seized by the Jews, and they were about to kill him, and I came to his rescue, brought him, and he's going to send him there. I also ordered that his accusers to present to you their case." He's just moving it up the ladder to Caesarea, to the governor of Judea. You hear the case, and decide, what's going on? I do not know what's going on here. Now, all of this is a plan, because God just told Paul, he says, "You also must testify about me in Rome." This is God's plan to get Paul to Rome. During the shipwreck that he's going to have, an angel is going to appear to him and say, "Stay strong. You're going to see," or not the shipwreck, there's a storm, they're in a hurricane. And the angel says, "Don't worry, stay strong. You must appear before Caesar." He's going to Rome, not to teach in the church. There's already a church there. He's not going there to, he's going to end up talking with the Jews, but he's not going there to split the synagogue. He's going to Rome to stand in front of Nero. That's the command. The emperor is Nero, and all of this is to get Paul face to face with Nero, and he's going to refer to it several times in these letters. He says, you know, I'm exactly where I'm supposed to be. It's like a government-sponsored evangelistic trip to Rome to present your doctrine to the emperor himself face to face, and he's going to be listening, making decisions. So it's peaceful. He's not threatened. He's just hearing the case, and Nero's going to dismiss the charges and set him free. But Nero's going to hear the gospel. This whole thing is to get Paul to stand in front of Nero. Now, while he's there, he's going to be there for 2 years. He's going to write all these letters. Okay, chapter 24, verse 1. 5 days later, the high priest Ananias went down to Caesarea with some of the elders and a lawyer named Tertullus, and they brought their charges against Paul before the governor, and that governor would be Felix. But now I want to show you this, because this is also interesting, I think. This is Caesarea. Now, what you see right here is the Mediterranean Sea. We're on the coast. This is the Hippodrome. These are seats. And this right here is a racetrack for racing chariots. You can see right here the center line right here. That's the median. That's the center line. You'd run a race around this way. You can go down this end and you can still see the stone walls of the starting line where the chariot would be in. It's each, there's like six of them there, and they'd come down and they'd race around, and the fans would sit here and cheer. Right here is a whole government building complex built by Herod. It was Herod's palace, and he wanted a freshwater pool. You've got the Mediterranean Sea. It's salt water. I want fresh water in my pool. So there's an aqueduct system that start. You can see it down here. We'll look at it. That pumped water, fresh water into the city, but it also pumped fresh water into his pool. So these pillars and stuff are the remains of Herod's palace that was then inherited by his son, Herod Agrippa the First. Remember, Herod Agrippa the First dies here because he stood up and they all shouted, he has the voice of a god, and then he died and was eaten by worms. He had worms in him. His son now, Agrippa the Second, is going to come up in the story in the book of Acts. Now that's all taking place here. Here's some more pictures. You got this? Mediterranean Sea, racetrack, the Hippodrome, the seats, and this is a government complex here with a palace remains with a swimming pool in it. Here we go. There's a track. You can see right there in the center. And here is, of course, there's Tony. She's down. See right there on the center of the track? She's going around the track, Mediterranean Sea. Palace is here. Hippodrome's all right here. Now we're into the palace complex. The track's over here. The palace complex continues down this way. This is the remains of it. Here's Tony standing. Now this is important. There's the Hippodrome. The track's over here. This is one of the courtrooms where the Bema seat would have sat. And this is generally the area where the lawyers would stand and make their presentation. Paul possibly stood right there on that pavement, right there. That is where this takes place. When he's gonna appear before Felix, he's gonna appear before Festus. In fact, Felix calls him several times. He liked talking with him, hoping he'd give him a bribe so he'd get him out of prison. So Felix, Festus, and Herod Agrippa II, Herod the Great's great-grandson, is going to hear Paul speak right here and share the gospel. The Sanhedrin heard it. The high priest heard it. Now the governors are hearing it. Herod's great-grandson's hearing it, all while Paul's being shipped to Rome at government expense so Nero can hear it. I mean, that's just an amazing, it's like, it looks like a disaster. It's like, it looks like nothing's working out. Yeah, no, everything's working out. It's like, when you say God works in mysterious ways, I mean, I don't want to use some kind of cliche because it's pretty obvious once you look at it. But Paul, just don't get discouraged. You just sit here and wait. They'll call you. When it's time for you to preach, they'll call you in. In fact, they'll invite some of their other guests. Well, here we go. There's the floor. You see that, you recognize that, the Hippodrome again. Now we're looking into the swimming pool. That's me standing in Herod's swimming pool. This is the remains of his palace. He carved it, cut his bedrock, cut it down, and built pillars around it. This is his pool. All this, there it is, I'm inside there. You see, this is all built on. This is cut, this is not natural. It's a square cut out of the bedrock, a freshwater swimming pool. So Herod can have fresh water. I don't want to swim in salt water. I want to swim in fresh water. Are you swimming, Herod, or what are you doing here? But anyway, that's it. There it is again. You can see some of the remains is all cut out. That's all carved. See the pillars? Some of the fault that's all collapsed in there. That's remains of that swimming pool. Now we're coming. That's up in the swimming pool, looking on some of the. This would be like the, the administrative part that we were talking about, and that's where Felix and Festus would be. There it is again. This is a different year. That's that same place. This would be the place, the courtroom right there. Paul would have stood. He would have been in prison. This is where Paul's going to be in prison, in some kind of a jail holding cell here in this palace, where Felix, Festus are going to be the governors. And when they bring him out, this is where the court cases would take place, right outside the hip. He would probably look out his prison window and watch the chariot races. I'm not sure. There's some more pavement. There's some more pavement going around there. See how that's kind of interesting? There's some pavement. That's kind of cool. That's the pavement. That's pretty good tile work from 2,000 years ago. It's still there. This was found there in the excavation. This says Tiberium Pontius Pilate, prefect of Judea. When he was the governor, Pontius or Pilate donated or dedicated something to the governor or the emperor Tiberius at the time, and he put this plaque up to identify, this was built by me in honor of the emperor, and all we've got left is this right here. And it was found in reuse in somewhere else. There it is again, a close-up. So there's Pilate, the definition of Pilate. There's Tony pointing down. Look at this. This is part of our story. Along the coast, these are all things that have come up out of the, all around the water. Because Paul's about to get on a ship, and they're going to have all kinds of problems. These are anchors. See that? They're rocks with holes cut in them with a string, a rope around them to throw over. There's a wooden anchor. There's a vessel. These are all things that were just... There's vessels that would be, you know, that they'd take wheat or something in or whatever. There's the aqueduct coming in with the fresh water. There's a Roman aqueduct still standing. And I got a better picture. I went up and took pictures, and you see where the water flows. And there's what I took that picture right there of our birthday girl right there. This is the review very quickly. This is the second missionary journey. Philippi was started. He's going to write a letter to the Philippians. Comes down here. Remember, Athens, the Corinthian church gets started, and then he goes back to Jerusalem. That was 49 to 52 AD. Then this trip right here, we talked about it, he goes on his second, leaves Antioch, comes up here, picks up Timothy, comes through Colossae. He's going to write a letter to the Colossians and Philemon in Colossae. And Ephesus, he's going to go on the third missionary journey, comes up to Troas, and then that's where he writes the Corinthian letter. This is where he meets Titus and comes down after having written 2 Corinthians and spends time in Corinth, and then he goes to Jerusalem. And that is where he's at today. When he goes on, we picked it up, he is in the house of riot, and now he's in Caesarea, right here where he's been going, and they're going to have a trial. The high priest is coming there. That's where we're at right now in chapter 24, verse 1. 5 days later, the high priest Ananias went down to Caesarea with some of the elders and lawyer. And Paul was called, and you know where he's standing. You know where he's standing. You can see where he was standing. That's why I showed you that. I just wanted you to see that this is not fiction. We have the locations of Fort Antonia. We have the remains of the temple. We have where Paul would have been in court, where he would have been in prison. He said, "We have found this man, Paul, to be a troublesome," this is a lawyer talking, "stirring up riots among the Jews all over the world. He is a ringleader of the Nazarene sect and even tried to desecrate the temple, so we seized him. By examining him yourself, you will be able to learn the truth about all these charges we are bringing against him." The Jews joined in accusations, asserting that these things were true. When the governor motioned for him to speak, Paul replied. Now here's Paul's defense. He says, "I know that for a number of years you have been a judge over this nation, so I gladly make my defense. You can easily verify that no more than 12 days ago, I went up to Jerusalem to worship. My accusers did not find me arguing with anyone at the temple or stirring up a crowd in the synagogue or anywhere in the city, and they cannot prove to you the charges they are now making against me, that he brought a Gentile in. However, I admit that I worship the God of our fathers. Now here comes this testimony. The God of our fathers as a follower of the way, which they call a sect. I believe everything that agrees with the law and that is written in the prophets, and I have the same hope in God as these men that there will be a resurrection. And so he brings that up again, of both the righteous and the wicked. So I strive always to keep my conscience clear before God and man. After an absence of several years, I came to Jerusalem to bring my people gifts for the poor, that's the money, and to present offerings. I was ceremonially clean when they found me in the temple courts doing this. There was no crowd with me, nor was I involved in any disturbance, but there were some Jews from the province of Asia, and they explains that situation right there, and they stood before the Sanhedrin. Verse 22, then Felix, watch this, verse 22, then Felix, who was well acquainted with the way, adjourn the proceedings. When Lysias, the commander, comes, he says, I will decide your case. So now the commander from Fort Antonia is going to come and share his information. He ordered the centurion to keep Paul under guard, but gave him some freedom and permit his friends to take care of his needs. Several days later, Felix came with his wife, Drusilla, who was a Jewess. He sent for Paul and listened to him as he spoke about faith in Christ Jesus. So he's basically listening to Paul, not defend himself, but preach the gospel, teach about Christ. As Paul discoursed on righteousness, self-control, and the judgment, I mean, it's like he's reviewing one of his epistles with him. And the judgment to come, Felix was afraid and says, that's enough for now. You may leave. When I find it convenient, I will send for you. At the same time, he was hoping that Paul would offer him a bribe, so he'd send for him frequently and talked with him. When 2 years had passed, Felix was succeeded by Festus, and because Felix wanted to grant a favor to the Jews, he let Paul in prison. So Festus now comes in. 3 days after arriving, chapter 25, in the province, Festus went up from Caesarea to Jerusalem, where the chief priests and Jews were appeared before him, and they brought charges against Paul. After 2 years, they still know Paul's there. They want him taken care of. And they urgently requested Festus a favor to them to have Paul transferred to Jerusalem. Of course, that's an assassination plot. Paul was being held at Caesarea. I myself am going there soon. Let your leaders come with me, and we'll talk about it there. Verse 6, after spending 8 or 10 days with them, he went down to Caesarea, and the next day he convened the court and ordered that Paul be brought before him. So Paul's probably standing in that same spot again now, 2 years later. And you got a very similar situation taking place here. Chapter 25, verse 10, Paul answered, I am now standing before Caesar's court where I ought to be tried. In other words, they wanted him to go back to Jerusalem. And he tells Festus, he says, I'm where I should be. I'm a Roman citizen in Caesar's court under your leadership. I'm not going to go back and be tried in Jerusalem. I have not done any wrong to the Jews, as you yourself know very well. If, however, I am guilty of doing anything deserving death, I do not refuse to die. But if the charges brought against me by these Jews are not true, no one has the right to hand me over to them. Now watch this right here. This is a huge line right here. You're not going to hand me over to them. I want to go to Caesar. I appeal to Caesar. He said, you've got to make a decision. Either you need to let me go because I'm innocent, but you're not going to send me with these Jews because I'm a Roman citizen where I'm supposed to be. The court system works this way. It doesn't have you hand me over to the Jews and them decide the case. You decide the case. If you want to call me innocent, let me go. If you want to kill me, kill me. But if you're not going to make a decision, I appeal to Caesar. Have Caesar decide my case. And that's the law. So after a few days later, King Agrippa and Bernice arrived at Caesarea to pay their respects to Festus, since he just arrived. Since they were spending many days there, Festus discussed Paul's case with the king. He says, there is a man here. And he explained the case to him. And I told him that it is not the Roman custom to hand over a man before he has faced his accusers. So anyway, they say, oh, that'd be fun. I'd like to hear that case. And so you look in verse 30 or 22. Then Agrippa said to Festus, I would like to hear this man myself. He replied, "Tomorrow you will hear him." The next day, Agrippa and Bernice came with great pomp and entered the audience room. And that, I think, is that room where Tony was standing. They entered that audience room, and there's music playing and announcers and the room with high-ranking officials. So now you've got all these high-ranking officials, and they're asking for a sermon from Paul. Tell us your case and tell us your views. Paul was brought in. And Festus, King Agrippa, and all who are present with us, you see this man? The whole Jewish community has petitioned me about him in Jerusalem, and here in Caesarea, shouting that he ought to be not to live any longer. I found that he had done nothing deserving death. In verse 27, for I think it is unreasonable, he says, I need to write his charges. He wants to go to Caesar, and I've got to write charges, but I've got no charges. I mean, it's like this guy's just annoying people. Well, Caesar's going to laugh at that. He's got bigger issues than just annoying people on the Temple Mount. So he says, I need to find something. He says, for I think it unreasonable to send on a prisoner to Caesar without specifying the charges against him. Then Agrippa said to Paul, you have permission to speak for yourself. So this is Herod the Great's great-grandson saying to Paul, you have my permission to speak. So Paul motioned with his hand, which is interesting, began his defense. King Agrippa, I consider myself fortunate to stand before you today as I make my defense against all the accusations of the Jews, and especially so because you are well acquainted with all the Jewish customs and controversies. Therefore, I beg you to listen to me patiently. The Jews all know, and they talk about his life right there, and he goes, I too was convinced I should be killing them. Then he talks about in chapter 26, verse 12, he starts talking about his journey to Jerusalem. And then look in verse 19. I've got to wrap this up. So then King Agrippa, I was not disobedient to the vision from heaven when he's talking about seeing Jesus. First to these in Damascus, then to those in Jerusalem and all Judea and Gentiles also, I have preached that they should repent and turn to God and prove their repentance by their deeds. Now, this is Paul sharing his ministry. That is why the Jews seized me in the temple court and tried to kill me. But I have had God's help to this very day, and so I stand here and testify to the small and great alike. I am saying nothing beyond what the prophets and Moses said would happen, that the Christ would suffer and the first, as the first to rise from the dead, would proclaim light to his own people and to the Gentiles. At this point, Festus interrupted Paul's defense. You are out of your mind, Paul, he shouted. Your great learning is driving you insane. I am not insane, most excellent Festus, replied Paul. What I'm saying is true and reasonable. The king is familiar with these things, and I can speak freely to him. I am convinced that none of this has escaped his notice, because it was not done in a corner. King Agrippa, do you believe the prophets? I know you do, because he's Jewish. He had a Jewish background. I know you do. Then Agrippa said to Paul, do you think that in such a short time you can persuade me to be a Christian? Notice how he uses the word Christian. Paul replied, short time or long, I pray God that not only you, but all who are listening to me today may become what I am, except for these chains. The king rose, and with him the governor and Bernice, and those sitting with them, they left the room, and while talking with one another about the case, they says, this man is not doing anything that deserves death or imprisonment. Meaning right there, that is this man's innocent. They all, Festus, Bernice, and Herod Agrippa, let him go. He's innocent. Agrippa said to Festus, this man could have been set free if he had not appealed to Caesar. But if he'd been set free, he would have walked out of the courtroom there in Caesarea and been assassinated. But instead, he's going to go on government protection all the way across the Mediterranean Sea, protected by the Roman Empire himself to get to Caesar. And then, of course, on the way, Satan's going to try to destroy him with the storm. And Paul sails for Rome. When it was decided that we would sail for Italy, Paul and some of the prisoners were handed over to the centurion named Julius, who belonged to the Imperial Regiment. He boarded a ship that gives the name of the ship, and they set sail. The next day, we landed in Sidon. But if you look on your notes very quickly, I do want to show you, so we don't, I wanted to cover this tonight. Look on page 3. There's Acts 25, 10 through 12, but Paul said, I'm standing before Caesar's tribunal where I ought to be tried, and then I appeal to Caesar. In Acts 26, 32, and Agrippa said to Festus, this man could be set free, but he had appealed to Caesar. And then the verse I wanted to get to, chapter 27, verse 21 through 24, Paul stood, this is they haven't eaten, they're in a hurricane, they've thrown things overboard, and he stands up among the prisoners and the Roman soldiers and says, men, you should have listened to me and not put out for sail from Crete and incurred this injury and loss. Yet now I urge you to take heart, for there will be no loss of life among you, but only the ship. We've already lost the cargo, we're going to lose the ship, but no one's going to die. For this very night there stood before me an angel of God to whom I belong and to whom I worship, and he said, do not be afraid, Paul, you must stand before Caesar. I mean, again, he's not going to the Church of Rome. He'll meet the Christians. He's not going to the synagogues in Rome. He'll meet some of the Jews while he's waiting. He's going to Rome to testify to Caesar, just like he did the Sanhedrin, just like he did the high priest, just like he did the governor Felix, the governor Festus, Herod Agrippa, Bernice, all the dignitaries. Now he's on a ship, government expense. Now, if they let him go, the Jews are going to kill him. So God's taking him by Roman protection to Nero, and he's going to stand in front of Nero, and before Nero goes crazy, he's going to have 2 years, at least he's going to have two trials. He's going to have a first and second trial. He's going to refer to it in these, where he's going to appear. I've already appeared before the emperor, and I'll appear again to be dismissed. But Nero's going to hear the gospel at least twice from the mouth of Paul, and that's what this whole thing is about, that right there. Now, on the back page, they're going to crash in Malta, and I'll probably refer to this next week, next time we talk. There is still, on February 10th, on the island of Malta, it's called the Feast of St. Paul's Shipwreck. They still remember the date. Now, again, if it's accurate, I don't know. But they still celebrate every year. It's been a Christian island. Like 85% of the island is Christian yet today. The person that, the guy that was the leader that Paul went to see, Publius, who was recognized as the first bishop of Malta, he was there when Paul got bit by a snake, and Paul was healing people, including the leader of the island. The leadership has gone, they can trace their lineage back to that moment, and Publius was the first elder, and they've had elders ever since on the Isle of Malta, which is interesting. They celebrated this year, they celebrated the Feast of St. Paul landing. Now, you don't hear about it, but it's if you handed it down on an island of where the ship landed, what happened, and then it's recorded in the Bible, they and it's not like it became Muslim and then they went back and pretended they remembered. It's never been, they had been times where they were invaded or challenged, but that never broke that line of Christianity from the island of Malta ever since it began. We'll start these books next week. I just wanted you to see kind of what gets him in prison, and from there we'll talk about that next time. No class next week. We'll be back here in 2 weeks. I'll pray, and you're free to add some content if you'd like to. Father, we do thank you for the chance to look into these things. We thank you for your word. We thank you for the preservation you have for Christianity, and we especially thank you for the understanding that you are leading us, you are guiding us, and you are doing your will in our lives, even though we may feel like we're imprisoned or we're misunderstood or we're shipwrecked, abandoned on an island. You're taking us to the place you want us to be as long as we continue to follow you and trust that your will is being done. We do thank you for this in Jesus' name. Amen.